From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Noah Adams. The Bush administration has agreed to add the polar bear to the list of plants and animals protected by the Endangered Species Act. That law requires the preservation of the bear's habitat. But in this case, that may not be an easy thing to do. The biggest threat to polar bears is melting sea ice linked to global warming. And as NPR's John Nielsen reports, today's listing comes with a caveat.
Interior secretaries don't often hold press conferences to announce endangered species listings, but that's what Dirk Kempthorne did today when he officially declared the polar bear a threatened species. Kempthorne said he made the call for three main reasons. First, he said, Arctic sea ice is essential to the polar bear's survival.
Second, the polar bear's sea ice habitat has dramatically melted in recent decades. Third, computer models suggest sea ice is likely to further recede in the future.
Kempthorne said he'd been convinced that melting sea ice forecasts issued by computer models were both accurate and scary. But he didn't seem to have much faith in the idea that global warming was behind the melting trend. And he said environmentalists shouldn't plan to use the Endangered Species Act, or ESA, to force government action on climate change.
Listing the polar bear as threatened can reduce avoidable losses of polar bears, but it should not open the door to use the ESA to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from automobiles, power plants, and other sources. That would be a wholly inappropriate use of the Endangered Species Act. ESA is not the right tool to set U.S. climate policy.
Kempthorne says that's why he added some unprecedented language to the polar bear listing. It essentially tries to limit the listing's impact on the energy industry. John Kostiak, a climate change expert at the National Wildlife Federation, called it an attempt to run away from the obvious implications of the listing.
If you are a coal plant belching global warming pollution, you are contributing to the extinction of the polar bear. He's not willing to say that. And so he said, we're going to put out a rule that tells every contributor to global warming pollution that we can't make any causal connection to your activity and the loss of sea ice, which is scientifically incorrect. It will never stand the test of time.
Kostiak says environmentalists will almost certainly sue to get this language stricken. That could send the fight over how to protect this species back into court for a long time. Fortunately, there are at least 20,000 polar bears in the world right now, and in recent years that number has been rising. But polar bear experts say those trend lines may start changing soon. Recent studies in places like Canada's Hudson Bay appear to show that the bears are getting smaller, eating less, and dying younger. In other words, these bears may be starting their decline. John Nielsen, NPR News, Washington.
It's 5 o'clock. Carolyn's still asleep upstairs. And I'm just starting out. Here I go.
This is National Ride Your Bike to Work Week, culminating Friday, Ride Your Bike to Work Day. So I got an early start.
If you get out on your bike, you'll find it's not so bad going to work this way. You always arrive in a good mood.
I often ride to work. It's still dark when I leave home, 5 o'clock or so. The streetlights made humble by an enormous moon hanging over a marshy tidal area on the way out to the real city streets. Even there, though, it's quiet.
I confess I don't always stop for the stop signs. At this hour of the morning, there's absolutely nobody on the road.
People look disbelieving when I say I bike to work in Los Angeles. But the terrain is mostly flat, and the California climate is perfect for this. It's easy virtue here, but still some virtue. The World Watch Institute says 1 4-mile round trip by bicycle saves about 15 pounds of pollutants in the atmosphere.
I read about bicycle commuting a little bit before I started out today. Number one city in the country for bicycle commuting, Portland, Oregon. 3.4% of commuters go by bicycle. Nationally, the average is 0.4%. So out of 100 people, 99 are in their cars. Less than half of one is on a bicycle.
I measured once when I drove. It's 5.5 miles to work. I don't understand how this is, but it takes 20 minutes in the car and only a little more than 30 on the bike. I'm not pedaling that fast.
Oh, that's not good. I shouldn't have run that one.
I wear a vest with a flashing light, but the best protection is to be aware and use a little caution and don't ride in the rain.
I'm at Duquesne and Culver Boulevards. I'm going to cross over Culver here.
It's less than a mile to NPR West from here, and there's a familiar car slowing down.
Oh, look, there's Alex Chadwick riding his bicycle to work. He's got a little blinking light on his back.
It's Mr. Steve. Hey, how are you doing out there?
Good. You look good on your bike.
Hey, I'll see you later.
The whole sky is light now. I turn past the Culver City Vehicle Depot and coast down the driveway to our building. At this hour, it's always going to be a good day.
Good morning, Alex.
Steve, good morning.
How was the ride in?
Well, it was pretty good. It's always a good ride in, actually. So many birds that are really out at this hour singing. You just kind of absorb a lot more on your bicycle. Okay, let's go do some radio now.
Today, Nissan joined the long list of automakers worried about the weak U.S. economy. It released its earnings report, and along with the warning about tougher times ahead, came a pledge. Nissan CEO said he wants to make his company the global leader in producing zero-emission vehicles, and he wants to do it over the next 5 years. Some industry analysts reacted with skepticism, since up to this point, Nissan has not led the pack in hybrid or electric research. Dustin Dwyer of Michigan Radio has this story on Nissan's aspirations.
Carlos Ghosn is a revered figure at Nissan. Born in Brazil, raised in France, Ghosn is considered the man who saved Nissan from bankruptcy. Today in Tokyo, Ghosn stood in front of a room full of photographers, and he made a simple case for electric cars. He said the number of people buying cars around the world is going up. At the same time, the need to cut emissions is getting more desperate.
There is a perceived conflict between the demand for more cars and the demand for a cleaner planet. 10%, 20%, or 30% lower emissions cannot be the only answer.
So Ghosn says 100% lower emissions should be the goal. Other executives in the auto industry have made this case before, but when they talk about building zero-emission cars, they talk about doing it a decade from now. But Ghosn says he plans to get a pollution-free vehicle on the road much sooner.
Today, there is latent global demand, but no offer. Nissan has an opportunity to mass market an affordable car that is both independent from oil and environmentally neutral.
Ghosn says Nissan will have these cars on the road in 2 years for government fleets in the U.S. and Japan. He says the cars will be in mass production by 2012.
It feels like a target that I'm not sure they're going to make.
Stephanie Brinley is an industry analyst with Auto Pacific. She says Nissan is far behind Toyota and General Motors in developing a new high-powered battery that's needed for an electric car. But even if Nissan can get a battery breakthrough, Brinley says the company will still have to convince people that electric cars are worth buying.
Particularly with the U.S. market, we haven't been all that accepting of electric vehicles before. So it has to be something pretty darn amazing to really get us to think about it.
It is possible to buy an electric or zero-emissions car in the U.S., but not from a major auto manufacturer. And for the most part, the cars are tiny and they can't go very far. Then there's the Tesla, a sleek two-seater, but its cost puts it out of reach for most consumers. Brinley says to be successful, Nissan has to do better. And she says in the end, what's most important is that Nissan gets electric cars right, not that it gets them first. For NPR News, I'm Dustin Dwyer in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Paul McCartney got a new hybrid car, but the environmental value was canceled out before it could even start it. Lexus gave him the vehicle worth $158,000. But instead of sending it by ship, the company had it flown from Japan to England. A top environmentalist says that flight was the same as driving the car around the world 300 times, which is bad news for the former frontman of Wings. Monday's earthquake in China has a precedent. It was comparable to the great San Francisco earthquake of 1906. Both were of the same magnitude. Both tore open about 200 miles of fault line. Both shook the ground for what felt like an eternity. And both toppled structures that simply were not built to sustain that amount of movement. Here's NPR's Richard Harris.
Seismologist Lucy Jones of the U.S. Geological Survey lives in California, but she used to live in Sichuan Province near the scene of this week's quake.
The earthquake occurred on the Lungmanshan Fault. It's sort of like the San Andreas for California, that's one of the really big faults to cause a lot of problems.
Now, the comparison isn't perfect. Movement along the San Andreas is caused by continental plates sliding past one another. Quakes on the Lungmanshan Fault are the result of a head-on collision.
The big picture is that India is moving into Eurasia and doesn't stop. And the Himalayas have been pushed up, and India still doesn't stop. So actually, China is being squeezed out over the Pacific Ocean to make way for India to continue barreling north.
Every so often, the stress in the rocks becomes too much. The result, a fault slips. This earthquake was huge because, like the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco, a lot of the fault gave way all at once.
And in this case, the fault's almost 200 miles long. And every point on that 200-mile-long fault is giving off energy. And it's one of the things we're trying to teach people here in California, that when we have our big San Andreas earthquake, it's going to be very different, not because it's so much more intense shaking at any moment, but in large part because so much larger an area will be involved.
Jones says shaking was not only widespread, but painfully long.
The bigger the earthquake, the longer it lasts. And this earthquake probably had a duration of maybe 70, 80 seconds.
So add that all together, and Jones is not surprised to see that this was a devastating quake. Seismologists have a way to estimate potential damage. They use a shaking intensity scale that goes from 1 to 10. Anything 8 or above means expect heavy damage.
In this earthquake, there are almost 1.5 million people exposed to either intensity 9 or 10. So there are just a huge number of people that are living right on top of really heavy levels of shaking, and the damage has to result from there.
Even so, Chinese-born structural engineer Chuhong Zhao was stunned to see the images and hear the death toll from Monday's quake.
I guess one thing that kind of surprised me was the casualties.
Zhao is an assistant professor at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. She's traveled often through Sichuan Province. She says, on the one hand, the Chinese government recognized that the area had high earthquake potential, so it called for fairly strict building codes. But that awareness didn't trickle down to the residents.
You have the seismic zone there, but I think the people there, they don't think that, you know, earthquake is something that they will think of in everyday life. It's not like in California, you know about earthquake, you talk about earthquake all the time.
She expects that most of the damage will turn out to have been in older construction, built before strict building codes came into existence. Many structures built more than 30 or 40 years ago were made simply of brick, and those buildings do poorly in earthquakes.
We're just guessing what's the reason, but I think really some serious investigation needs to be initiated to find out the reason.
Would you be interested in participating in that?
Yes, of course.
Rescue is everybody's first priority, but after that's complete, Zhao hopes to go back to China to find out why so many buildings collapsed and how to prevent future tragedies like this. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Hey, tomorrow the Bush administration has to make what could be a major decision about polar bears. A federal judge ordered the administration to decide if those bears belong in the federal endangered species list. And the ruling is important because polar bears are polar bears, as well as because a listing could force the government to do something about climate change. NPR's John Nielsen explains.
As of now, there are at least 20,000 polar bears living in the Arctic. Normally, an animal this numerous would not be considered for a spot on the endangered species list. But for polar bears, these aren't normal times. That's because the ice sheets the polar bears hunt on are shrinking, many believe due to global warming. Stephen Amstrup is a polar bear scientist in Alaska.
The nature of the sea ice is different. It's thinner, and its extent, especially in the summertime, is much reduced. Those conditions are projected to accelerate. And so we're concerned about polar bears for the future, not how they are in the present day.
Amstrup, who works for the U.S. Geological Survey, says it's possible that the main threat to polar bears is now man-made greenhouse gases. That concern became a legal issue about 3 years ago when the nonprofit Center for Biological Diversity filed a petition with the Department of the Interior. The Endangered Species Act requires the government to consider these kinds of petitions, but Cassie Siegel, the lawyer who wrote it, says it wasn't just designed to get the bear on the list.
But also to raise awareness of their plight and to try to make the point that global warming is not some future threat which is distant from people in time and space, but it's here, it's now, it's concrete, it's urgent, and it's local.
Early last year, the Bush administration issued a tentative response to the petition. It proposed to classify the world's remaining polar bears as threatened, but not endangered. After the government failed to issue a final ruling, activists like Siegel went to court to force tomorrow's deadline. Siegel hopes the Bush administration will strengthen its original plan tomorrow by declaring the bears endangered. That is important, she says, because endangered animals get more protection than threatened ones do.
The difference is that the government has the option to reduce certain protections to threatened species, and they cannot do that for endangered species.
Siegel and her colleagues hope to use an endangered species listing to force the government to cut greenhouse gas emissions. That's because this law requires the government to protect the habitats of endangered species, which in this case means taking steps to stop the Arctic sea ice from melting. But critics of the idea of a polar bear listing say it's a bad idea for several reasons. Some object to the whole notion of protecting an animal on the basis of computer models designed to predict the effects of climate change. Others warn that a listing could force Americans to spend billions of dollars changing the way they use energy. Kenneth Green, a climate policy expert at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, says many will wonder whether it's worth it.
It's going to make Americans do what they've never done before, which is say, what am I willing to pay for that species in the Arctic, far north, that I'll never see, and if I did, would probably try to eat me.
Green thinks an endangered species listing could end up backfiring on the environmentalists.
The polar bear protection plan could cause such trouble that it leads to a reexamination of the entire Endangered Species Act.
Whatever the Bush administration decides tomorrow won't end the polar bear's problems. A team of federal biologists predicts that two-thirds of the world's polar bears could vanish in 50 years if the sea ice keeps melting at its present rate. John Nielsen, NPR News, Washington.